Cape Talk.
Plan B.
With Rebecca Davis. Good afternoon, Rebecca.
Good afternoon, John.
Did you spend all morning in front of the television watching considerably more abbreviated Supreme Court of Appeal proceeding than was expected?
Yes, I did. And that is all correct. In fact, what a strange morning in some regards, John, to see the SCA gathered there with seemingly everyone pretty much in agreement on everything.
It was kind of like, I said, the Constitutional Court hearing on Kundler, where the people who were, there were arguments, serious arguments, and plenty of back and forth between judges and lawyers, and then Zuma's lawyer in the Kundler case, Jeremy Gauntlet, steps up and says, my client concedes, and Kempe Kemp did exactly the same thing today.
That's right, as did the NPA's lawyer, Hilton Epstein.
Who appears to have had a really difficult day of it.
He came in for a pounding, so to speak, from the presiding Supreme Court Judge Mohammad Nafsa, as in fact did Kemp as well. Nafsa's not somebody you want to go in front of being remotely unprepared or unsure of your territory, and certainly I think the judges came off with the upper hand, definitely, during the tussles today. But so we had this strange spectacle of eventually both the NPA's counsel and President Zuma's counsel conceding that the decision to withdraw charges against Zuma had been irrational. So now the question is, John, how do we interpret this? Do we think that, you know, on the day these lawyers were kind of talked into a corner and they couldn't, or was this always going to be the case? Were they always going to get to Bloemfontein and then concede? In which case, why did they pursue this appeal? What is your read on that?
My read is that it's part of Zuma's intention to delay and delay and delay and delay and delay until the point where either it goes away or he is no longer vulnerable to an adverse finding against him in the way that he would be if he were to stand trial now.
I mean, there's no context, surely, in which he would not be vulnerable to an adverse finding in terms of the potential criminal liability.
Pardon when the next president comes in.
A pardon would perhaps be on the cards. Yeah, that's my interpretation too, that the decision to take this on appeal was purely delaying process, and now it's working, John.
I think they might have believed when they started the appeal process that they had a chance of winning, but I think probably as they started looking more and more at case law and the history of this, they began to concede to themselves that we have no chance of winning, but what the heck, let's go on with it anyway, because it uses up more time.
And it has worked. So even though it seems evident now that the Supreme Court is going to rule that the appeal be dismissed and that corruption charges be reinstated, they could still take several weeks, perhaps months, to come back with that finding. Only after which will a new indictment be served on Zuma. And already there seems to be some procedural tussling as to how exactly the new charges will be instated and whether Zuma's counsel will have the right to make fresh representations to the NDPP about potential unfairness and so forth. What I thought was interesting, John, was the clear anxiety on the part of the NPA head, Sean Abrahams, that came out through his lawyer, Hilton Epstein, with Hilton Epstein basically begging the Supreme Court to put down in the judgment exactly what, and I quote, Mr. Abrahams must do now. So clearly, Sean Abrahams wanted a directive from the Supreme Court to say, now the corruption charges must be reinstated. He wanted nothing left up to chance, because, you know, who wants to be seen? I mean, if you're Abraham,
well, somebody wants to go down with a positive gloss attached in history, says, leave the decision up to me, and if the charges were irrationally dismissed, then they remain. Proceed with indicting the president.
In a perfect world. But we know that Abraham's Abrahams is not that decisive, and that
it's his opportunity to become that decisive.
But as I'm saying, what Epstein was expressing there was clearly so much anxiety from the part of Sean Abrahams about what he was going to do, that he will now have to sit down and reinstate those charges. And the judges of the Supreme Court were just having none of it. I mean, seeming absolutely bemused, saying, one of them said, Achak Kachalia said, what is Mr. Abrahams' problem? You know, it's so simple. The charges now have to be reinstated. What on earth is the issue here? And Hilton Epstein just saying, no, but, you know, Mr. Abrahams just wants to know what to do. What to do? What must he do? I actually felt sorry for him. I felt sorry for Epstein. I felt sorry for Abrahams, for goodness sake, in the end. And it did seem like, in fairness, the DA wants the same thing from the Supreme Court, because I saw in the statement that James Salfon from the DA just put out, they too have asked the Supreme Court to specify, to clarify exactly what steps must be followed now.
Yeah, I'm speaking to a law professor after 5 o'clock, and one of the questions I want to ask is, how legally acceptable would it be for the Supreme Court of Appeal to be that directing,
right,
in terms of separation of powers? And I'm looking forward to hearing the answer to that question.
Yes, because that has been one of the issues at stake in this case too, the suggestion that the court must not be seen to trespass on the terrain of other arms of government. So it well may be the case that they are reluctant, but clearly we're all just crying out for them to give some direction on when Zuma will face this day in court.
There is another African election next month. The citizens of Liberia are going to the polls again, and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has been in power for 12 years?
12 years,
Africa's first woman president. And you sent me an interesting piece from The Conversation suggesting that her 12 years in power should not necessarily be seen as triumphant for women's progress.
Interesting that. So the most evident metric to base this on is the fact that in next month's election, only 16% of candidates, both nationally and locally, I think, are women. And, you know, there's evidence throughout Johnson Sirleaf's presidency that she has not been perhaps taken on, you know, the mantle of women's champion in the way that many would expect her to as Africa's first woman president. So she has not backed legislation about bringing more women into politics. She termed feminism extremism. She hasn't appointed many women herself. She has, in fairness, introduced an anti-rape law, which apparently only finds manifestation in Monrovia, but still, that is something. But the point is here, she's yet another illustration, isn't she, John, of this point we've often made, that simply appointing a woman or simply having a woman elected into top leadership does not guarantee that the lot of women will be improved.
But Abili Dlamini and Faith Mutambi are two very, very, very pertinent examples in point. I wasn't aware of the distinction between feminism and femocracy. Femocracy was not a concept which has been familiar to me.
Me neither. And I think it was, in fact, coined by this Nigerian scholar, Amina Mama, who distinguishes between feminism, under which she includes attempts to shatter the glass ceiling for women, and femocracy, which she classes as rule by women, but which keeps the existing power hierarchy intact, which is what she suggests that Johnson Sirleaf has done and what many other female leaders throughout the world have done, most obviously perhaps Margaret Thatcher. So the question is, John, I mean, people like me are always kind of agitating about women getting to the top echelons of power. But if they're in that position and they don't do anything to bring other women up with them, is there in fact any difference from that perspective in having a man or a woman on top?
I would argue that, I mean, I don't know what she would be like in this regard or in any regard, but if Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma were to become the next president of the ANC and therefore the next president of the country, either prematurely or, through the next elections in 2019, I'm not at all convinced that she would be good for women or necessarily better for women than Zweli Mkhize or Cyril Ramaphosa.
It's an interesting question. I was thinking, I went to see Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma in Nyanga on Sunday, and I was thinking in the course of her speech that I think she is in the model of a kind of socially conservative African elder. And you could kind of tell that by the kind of causes she clearly feels strongly about. So, you know, lecturing about the dangers of alcohol and drugs and warning young girls not to get pregnant, etc. So from that perspective, I think that she will be in the mold of a sort of headmistressly figure. And I think you're right. I don't think that would come with particular benefits for women. However, the one factor that we can't really measure in a quantitative way, but I think is important, is the kind of optic power and the symbolic power of young girls simply seeing that a woman can take charge, that a woman can be on top. And that might seem like a relatively trivial thing, but I think it has power. You know, just the idea that a woman can be president, that is not something out of bounds, I think has a certain force on its own. Of course, if it was accompanied by actual policies improving the lot of women, that would be great.
Two sentences or less for emails. I don't like long-winded emails. I try never to write them, and I hate receiving them, but if I were to be restricted to emails of no more than two sentences, as one is restricted in Twitter by Twitter to no more than 144 characters, I'd have a great deal of difficulty.
I mean, that sentence alone, John, was probably about...
Well, that was very long-winded. That was probably particularly long-winded words. Even for me.
I brought this up because I emailed someone this week and I got a response back, a very terse response, I should add, with the email signature which read, "Why is this email two sentences or less?" And then a link to this page, which simply says, "Email takes too long to respond to, suggesting we treat all email responses like SMS text messages using a set number of letters. We count sentences instead. Why not adopt the personal policy? All email responses will be two sentences or less." It is that simple. So obviously I flagrantly disregarded this in my response because this person I was emailing was actually a source who I needed to ask a number of long-winded questions to. I sent him this essay and then of course he had to respond and said, "Will you phone me?" Since I assume
he actually refuses to say yes. That he appears to apply this two-sentence policy strictly.
I think he is living it, right. And obviously it didn't appeal to me as somebody with a terror and phobia of the phone. I would much rather write a manifesto over email than ever have a phone call. But I do like the idea of having an exercise where you simply try to force yourself to constrain your utterances to two sentences, because I'm sure we all do use a lot of very unnecessary verbiage simply to be nice or polite. And
I'm not often accused of being nice and polite. But I mean, I do sometimes simply for that reason, because I reply to somewhere around 150 emails in a 24-hour cycle, and in order to cut down on the amount of time I spend on each email, I quite often ignore the "Dear Sarah, thank you very much for your email. My response is regards, John." You know, I answer the question or rebut the assumption or whatever the case may be. And then people get quite cross with me sometimes.
I was friendly
to you. Why weren't you friendly back to me?
I think it would be wonderful if we could all agree not to be offended if you do away with the greetings and endings in responding. I understand if you're emailing someone cold, of course you must say, "Dear John, regards Rebecca." But in responding, I think we should all just agree it's perfectly fine to do away with that verbiage around greetings, John. I'm with you.
Okay. Bare feet on aeroplanes? Jean obviously hates the...
Apparently this is the latest thing causing outrage on social media. The most disgusting thing you can do on a plane, they suggest. I'm looking at your producer, Stefan, who, as a former flight attendant, seems to suggest this is by no means the most disgusting thing you can do on a plane. We can only imagine. But is the idea that you would poke your bare feet through the seat in front of you, such that your bare feet were resting on somebody else's armrest. It has been suggested that this is pretty bad. I mean, I have to agree.
It is pretty bad.
If the feet in question were besocked, however, would we feel differently?
I would. Because I hate having my shoes on when I'm flying.
Likewise.
So I take my shoes off and I take my socks off because I've generally been wearing them for some time before I arrive at the airport, and then there's always a long wait because I arrive fanatically early just in case something goes wrong, which it never does. So I end up twiddling my thumbs in the departure hall for hours and hours and hours, and my socks get sweatier and sweatier. And so I put on the airline socks, or I take a pair of fresh socks with me in my on...
I see.
And
you
bag.
Do swap them out.
I do.
Right. No, I agree. One has to, because also your feet swell up to little pig's trotters otherwise in your shoes, and you can't ever get them off. It's like Cinderella's stepsisters. Anyway, yes, I agree this is disgusting, but John, just this very week, there I was, minding my own business, driving down Sea Point Main Road, when I saw a chap, brazen as all get out, simply clipping his nails at the bus station. He was wearing slops, which he had sort of kicked off, and just in an attitude of supreme casualness and calm was just clipping each toe in turn. Where do you get the gall to do that, John? Is that not worthy of a citizen's arrest? I'm serious.
So only the toes. If that person had been manicuring the nails on the hand, you would have found that completely unobjectionable.
No. I would have found it objectionable, but substantially less objectionable.
Why? Why are you prejudiced against feet?
Because feet spend their lives literally just dredging through dirt on the ground.
That's literally in the sense of metaphorically.
No, I do mean literally in my case, John. Just burrowing in the dirt, whereas your hands are normally kept, you know, relatively clean. You wash them a lot more. Do you, during the day when you're at your colleague's hand basin, do you whip out your feet and just give them a little scrub halfway through the day?
No,
you don't.
Never done
precisely
that.
So feet in general are dirtier, and to clip your toenails in public is so foul, John. I mean, am I wrong? I'm clearly right.
No, you're clearly right. And I'm just wondering how I can put all of that into an email of two sentences and less to J.P. Smith, arguing that he bring in a social nuisance bylaw to cover exactly the egregious crime that you have just highlighted.
I'm behind that campaign 100%, John.
Thank you. Saw a man clipping fingernails on a plane. Yuck. Jeffrey.
Also not okay.
Oh, dear. Well, I wish her an incident-free drive home. I do. Yeah, bare feet on a plane, not good, eh? If you keep them strictly to yourself, that's fair enough. If you take off your socks and you fold your feet back under your seat and you keep them there for the 12 or 18-hour duration of the flight, I suppose, fair enough. But the minute you bring those feet into olfactory or visual reach of somebody else, they must be clad. That is my view. What is your view, folks? You can share it with us on these social faux pas. Rebecca, is it social faux pas or social faux pas? Faux pas, we think. I'm surprised the Seapoint Residents Association didn't call a meeting about the toenail clipping. Indeed, it's on the agenda of the next meeting. It's been put there as we speak.